Hello, writers. Have you ever bought a writing craft book someone says you just have to read?
Is it still sitting on your shelf? Have you even cracked the spine?
That's totally me.
Don't ask Renee how many craft books she owns.
Why do we keep buying these books we never read?
We all want to improve as writers, but that's hard to do alone.
That's why we started the Words to Write By podcast, to tackle these books together, chapter by chapter, and learn from their advice.
Or not. Sometimes they're wrong.
Hi, I'm Renee Nelson, former college writing instructor turned full-time writer and podcaster. After many years, I finally have a complete draft of my memoir.
And I'm Kim Smuga-Otto, author of the humorous fantasy series Boy Bands and Dragons. The first book, Our Comeback Tour, Slaying Monsters, will be released this year by Riverfolk Publishing.
And now, on with the podcast.
And that was our new intro.
What y'all think? You can let us know on our social media, on our Facebook, our Instagram, or LinkedIn.
Or you could show up on Wednesdays for our meetup group, where we alternate between a writer's process group, where we sit around and talk about various issues we have related to our writing and questions about publication. And we get a group of writers together and help each other answer questions. Or on the alternating Wednesdays, we do a writing sprint, where Renee does a micro lesson at the very beginning, and then we just are quiet for 2 hours and write. So, and you can tell us about our intro then.
You sound a little winded, like you just ran a marathon, like you just ran up and down your stairs.
Getting all the stuff?
Yeah.
Is
it recording?
Yes, it's recording.
Are you sure?
Yes, I'm sure.
Excellent.
Okay, so we are moving along on this book. And we are on
7 and 8.
7 and 8 and an appendix.
Mm-hmm. Did I ever tell you that I had my appendix removed?
Okay.
Is there more to the story? I don't know. It's an appendix, right? So it's funny that we've named the end of a book an appendix.
Ah. It's funny that we named the organ in the body the appendix.
Exactly what I'm saying. Anyway, do you think we should have removed this appendix in this
book? No, actually this is pretty useful.
It's pretty useful. Okay.
I think this one was. I think it spelled it out nice and clearly.
Okay, good. So mine wasn't any good, but this one was. Cut all that out. I was just trying to be fun. So we're doing 7 and 8 and the appendix. The first one.
8 and 9 and the appendix.
La, la, la. 8 and 9 in the appendix.
So for reference, we actually recorded this episode previously and I screwed up and I didn't actually have the recording on. So this is the second one and we're adding a bit of extra punch, so we're excited about it. We don't feel like we're repeating stuff we said last time.
Yeah, the podcasting gods were not kind to us, but they will be kind to us today.
Yes, because I'll double check it twice. Yes, recording.
Okay. All right. So number 8 is naming names.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This chapter did not impress me.
Really?
Initially, you think it's like, ooh, naming the person that did that horrible thing to you. Should you name them or not? But no, what she's saying is that you should include names of businesses and street names and locations and all those details that one would think if you're writing a memoir, you'd include automatically.
Yeah. So essentially, it's kind of an annex to the previous chapter that we covered, which was showing, not telling. So it's just another way to show. When you're using, you know, proper nouns.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know. I think, you know, when I was long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, when I was taking like my first composition class in college, I remember my teacher telling us to use specific names for things as a way to be more specific in your writing. Like, don't say, you know, oh, the tree was green. Say the spruce was a deep green. And I was like, oh, you name it. You name the tree. And I always carried that along with me.
I suppose it's one of those things that you need someone at some point to say it explicitly. And then it's like, oh, of course I'll do it.
Right. So there's somebody out there listening to us that are like, oh, it's obvious to us, but maybe it's not obvious to someone else. Maybe that's why she included it.
Yeah, maybe.
You're not impressed.
I mean, I liked the examples that she picked. They're beautiful pieces of writing, but some of them really didn't actually name that many things. Some of them did. Anyway, the reason she says to use names is, number one, it gives you authority. Someone reads and says, oh, that person really did grow up in the south side of Chicago in the 1970s.
Yeah, you can like flex a little bit for your reader. Like, oh, look at how much I know about this area.
Even if you actually had to go back and research it at the time.
Yeah.
It gives you a believability, and that's really important. The more your reader believes you that you know what you're talking about, the more they'll come along and enjoy your book.
Mm-hmm. In the very end, she says that a name, real or otherwise, is what lifts the writing out of generalization and anonymity.
And the thing about a memoir is it's a mix between, this is a very specific life that you did not experience, and therefore you get to see what it was like, and the emotions this person felt, the feelings, are stuff that you feel as well, so you feel a connection.
Yeah. You know, she didn't say this outright, but I have a feeling she meant for this chapter to speak to those people that are writing a memoir of place. One of the themes, one of the big themes in memoir can be you're writing about where you grew up or a place that means a lot to you. And for example, Harry Cruz, he wrote a biography of place, you know, and so it was all about him and how he grew up in the South. If your book is a memoir of place, you definitely have to use these names.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to hide what streets are because it's, you know, that's kind of a character now.
Right. Conversely, if you're writing a story about your childhood, you may realize from reading this chapter that, oh, the street I grew up on is actually important to all this.
Right. You know, it's interesting. This chapter is written kind of like an essay with very specific points in the topic sentences. Did you notice that?
No.
Oh, okay. Well, if there's a bullet point, if she had bullet points, she could have bullet pointed this.
Okay.
She says that the names of places often reveal a history of invasion and colonization. And she says that's one reason to include it. If you find that detail in the names, you might be able to, like, write about that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could do a little investigative reporting on the names of a place and why it is that name.
Right.
She also says sometimes certain place names acquire a resonance in the context of a particular narrator's story. Sometimes certain place names acquire a resonance in the context of a particular narrator's story. And to follow up this point, she brings in Jamaica Kincaid's memoir On Seeing England for the First Time.
Actually, that one only has one proper name besides England in it. But I suppose the point of it was to show how you could have a single place name resonate for the overall theme.
Right, right. Yeah, in it she talks about the White Cliffs of Dover. And I really love this first line. She says, the moment I wished every sentence, everything I knew that began with England would end with, quote, and then it all died. We didn't know how. It just all died, unquote, was when I saw the White Cliffs of Dover. But you're right. That's the only time Jamaica Kincaid actually mentions the White Cliffs of Dover. Oh, no, it's the only time that that's a place name mentioned. It's mentioned like four times in this passage, but that's it. There's only one proper noun here.
Yeah, there's not like the ship she was on when she saw them or the town she departed from or anything like that. Just,
yep, that's it. So maybe it doesn't have to be tons of place names?
When you're writing your memoir, you may discover that there's a particular place that then you can you find a particular place that can do more than just sit there as a location, but can actually build a story around it.
Mm-hmm.
And that can make your memoir more powerful.
Yeah.
Because, you know, whenever you can take your memoir and make it not about you for a little while, it's a bit of a relief.
True. You know, place does affect you, right? Mm-hmm. It like helps build an identity over time. So it's kind of important to describe the place. Like, for example, you came, what state did you come from again? Wisconsin?
Most recently. Yeah.
Most recently, Wisconsin. And where else were you from?
Minnesota.
Minnesota. Okay. So I know nothing about those places. And it's really fun when you talk about them. And I get the feeling like they're very much a part of your identity.
Yeah, a lot.
You know, even though, you know, you've become an honorary Californian.
Right.
You're welcome. Whereas me being from California, I don't know. Am I a typical Californian from your perspective?
No, you're not typical at all, Renee. You're unique.
Uh-huh. Right.
I mean, California's a pretty big state.
Oh, that's true. That's
true. And there's a whole bunch of different nationalities. Like, one out of every four people was born in another country that lives here. So
that's true. A lot of transplants. You
know, there's so many different Californian stories. But I do understand San Jose and that area a bit more because you spent time there.
Right. One of my things is that I spent time growing up a little bit in the Monterey area. And a lot of people know that place as a tourist, but they don't know it as a local. Mm-hmm. So I tend to lean into it a little bit. There are some shows, too. There is a show about Pacific Grove, I heard, but they totally botched it. Like, they didn't even stay in the town or anything for the show.
Yeah, and they also had people commuting all the way up to San Francisco from there.
Yeah, like, what? What? Like, I didn't ever actually saw the show, but I'm already a little angry. Like, that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, I mean, it would work perfectly if they were living in Santa Cruz, but nobody that glamorous with all those fancy shoes would ever live in Santa Cruz.
True, true. So,
I mean, I've got a rant here. So, we watched a movie a couple of years ago that was about this couple, and the woman was pregnant, and they were kind of looking at different places that they might want to live. And so they were going to these places and getting kind of a feedback from them. And there were two things that pissed me off about the show. Number one, in the end, they decided that where they really wanted to go was to her isolated cabin that she had inherited, where it was nice and quiet, and nobody was around, which is a really bad idea when you're just about ready to have your first kid, because you would be, it's unbelievable how much you appreciate having friends and family to help out at that point.
I see that.
So okay. I didn't buy that one at all. And the other thing was, they supposedly went to Madison, Wisconsin, and they used one of the UC schools or something for it. I mean, it was like columns and all that stuff, and people running around. It's like, that's not the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Would have been that hard just to have a couple of shots in the actual place. The believability of that movie went way down, which was too bad because I really liked the actors, but
That's disappointing. What was the movie? You know, maybe it's not worth mentioning.
Well, I'll mention in the show notes. We have wonderful show notes on each of our episodes that Renee does.
Yes.
We'll include it in our show notes.
Yeah, okay. We'll talk crap about it on our show notes.
Chapter 9.
Wow, that was fast. Okay, that is all that we have to say about Chapter 8.
Except that we're actually going to do our exercise from it, so we might cover a bit more on the exercise.
Yeah, we'll come back to those suggestions for writing. So now we're on Chapter 9, writing about living people.
And again, I was less than impressed.
Really?
Well, I thought that she had a bunch of really good points here that she'd actually covered mostly in her earlier section on truth-telling.
So why is this in here?
I mean, here's a good reason for it. If I were going to pick up a book on memoir, one of the things I'd be wondering is, like, will it tell me how to write about real people? Oh, look, there's a whole chapter on it. Yeah, I'll pick it up.
Yeah. I do know that a lot of people who are writing memoir worry about, like, oh, I'm writing about this person. Will they get mad at me for telling this story or doing this thing? And this chapter, it does not talk about the legal stuff, which we are going to cover that today in the appendix, because that's what the appendix talks about. But this chapter focuses on the ethical reasons for naming names and what issues might come up with that.
Mm-hmm.
So you were less impressed.
I just felt that a lot of this was kind of covered before. And again, I mean, maybe part of this is because I don't want to write memoir. So if I get a surface explanation, I'm just good with it. It's a bit like the Bickham one. Like, when we got further into the weeds, the Bickham, it just really wasn't very relevant to you.
Mm-hmm.
But since I was actively writing a piece of fiction, it's like, oh, wait a second. This particular technique of inserting a sequel into the middle of a scene and then back to the scene, you know, was like, oh, I could do that because I was deep into it. So maybe if someone was deep into doing their memoir, they might enjoy this. This chapter might be good because it, again, addresses that point with a slightly different take.
Right.
I liked how she said that what is most life enhancing when evaluating whether to use a person in a story or not, in your memoir or not. And the idea was that, you know, sometimes there's some injustice, and by exposing that injustice and having people attached to it, it actually will do something about it and thereby help everybody out. But sometimes if you're exposing an injustice where someone is caught in that system and they can't get out, it's just one more thing on top of them that's holding them down.
Yeah. I don't really have to worry about a lot of this.
Because everyone's dead?
Because everyone is dead. And you can't sue on behalf of a dead person. I do, on the other hand, to have some living relatives, and I've been debating whether or not to remove, just not even put them in there, you know? And it kind of makes me wonder, it's like, I don't necessarily worry about hurting their feelings. I think I'm more worried about, like, you know, them trying to retaliate against me for telling truths.
Right, you know? And she addresses that a little bit in that whole business about, like, you know, you shouldn't just write a book for revenge.
Right, exactly, and removing them would kind of take that out. She does have some practical things in here in this chapter. She says there's three ways to figure out whether or not you should name a name, like if you're worried about it in one way or another. And she says that you could just be selective about the things that you include. just, you know, don't put in the things that would harm someone in a story, which works for some people and doesn't work for others. She says that you can show your writing to the person that you wrote about. Mm-hmm. And I know that Mary Carr, and when I read her The Art of Memoir, she will take the pieces from her memoir, and she, when she wrote about a specific person, and she will give those pieces to that specific person.
But only those pieces.
But only those pieces, and she'll ask them what they think. And it, she said at first it freaked her out. She's like, oh my gosh, they're going to say no, I'm going to have to change a bunch of stuff. And she said, to her surprise, nobody seemed to care. And I think there was one person who was like, could you just like not put that little detail in it? She was like, yeah, yeah, it didn't matter. It didn't mean anything to the story by removing it. But yeah, if you are worried and you have a good relationship with the people in your story, maybe they would be okay with it. Maybe you could just print out the parts that you talk about them and give it to them, have them read it.
And that could also decrease the stress overall, because there's nothing like having a relative that's written a book that you know you're in and you're turning the pages and like, are they going to talk about this? Are they going to talk about this? And you have to go the entire way through the book thinking about that.
Yeah.
As opposed to if you know what the sections about you are, then you can just enjoy the whole thing. And then check out what they did, wrote about Grandma Mary.
Yeah, I know, right? And then the last bit of advice, which I think is really important. Maybe that is why this is in the book, this chapter. She says you can also decide not to worry about any of this until you've written the story and are thinking about publishing.
Mm-hmm.
It will stunt your writing groove if you worry.
Yeah.
About how it might affect somebody.
Yeah, it's a bit like turning off your inner editor when you're writing your draft of your story. You just have to push on ahead and see what you can find about these people. And then when you're going through and editing, you can decide. At that point, you can evaluate what you've got and decide if it's enhancing or not
right.
for the book.
It's much more practical advice than what Anne Lamott gave us.
Yes.
To give them a tiny little penis and then they won't come forward. All right. Anyway, so is there anything else you would like to say about this chapter?
Well, I did like the other point that she said that she came from a family where people did not talk about stuff. You know, they were quiet about their history. They did not, you know, talk about these things that had happened to them. And that just wasn't done. And when she wrote her book, she knew they would never bring up any things that she had mentioned because they just didn't talk about that. So she had kind of a cover. Like, even though she knew they might be unhappy, they wouldn't actually tell her that they were unhappy.
Right, right. They'd be like, oh, it's nice. So those two chapters, there wasn't much in them, but I think they were kind of important that she had to talk about them.
I want to mention that there's actually a really good set of prompts at the end of it.
Okay.
Which we will not do because all of them are stuff that you can write for yourself and be completely honest because nobody else will hear it.
Yeah.
So we are not going to write about a portrait of someone you hate, knowing that person will never see it because we're doing a podcast. However, if you get this book and you want to kind of experiment and see how far you can go with your writing about people, these are great exercises to do in a notebook that nobody will read.
Right, right. Definitely. Yeah, these are actually pretty good. These would be helpful for you trying to like stop thinking about or stop worrying about what someone's going to say and just focus on the writing.
Mm-hmm.
So then Kim was like, Renee, you need to just skip to the appendix. We're just going to talk about the appendix. I said, okay. So we're skipping three chapters and we're going right to the end. And why did we do that?
Because the appendix is all the legal implications of naming names. And it fits.
Okay. And this, I think, is what people are mostly worried about. I don't think they're so much worried about hurting someone's feelings. I think they're mostly worried about getting sued.
Well, for your memoir, you were.
Yeah.
I think it go either way. I think actually if you're writing about somebody you care deeply about, you might be worried that you will do some damage to the relationship.
That's true.
But, you know, financially, what you're kind of worried about is being sued.
Right. So she just begins the appendix by saying many writers engaged in writing memoir worry about being sued. For most, this is a way of focusing their fear of telling the truth. It is a legitimate legal concern, but only for very few.
This reminds me of my college psychology class where we got to the abnormal psych part of it. The instructor said, okay, just so you know, we're going through these characteristics. Neither you nor any of your family members have these things.
Whoa, really?
Well, basically, the college student that's learning about all these different dissociative personality and this and this, and then suddenly they go back home for Thanksgiving and their class, they know what everyone in their family has.
They're diagnosing everybody.
Yes. So this is very much like this. You know, these are things that can happen, but they won't happen to you.
Right.
And the reason she says it won't happen to you is that it is expensive to serve a lawsuit. It's one thing to hire a lawyer to send a nasty letter to you, but like the next step, they have to pay money out. And if they lose the case, then they have to pay more money out.
Right, because it's a civil suit.
So you're never going to go to prison for a memoir.
Right, you're not like breaking the law.
Right.
But you could, you know, someone could say, hey, this damages my image or something, and then they can come after you. And, you know, I highly doubt, I mean, maybe a lawyer would take this and be like, oh, yeah, you don't have to pay me. You know, we'll just win money and then I'll take a portion. I doubt they'd do that. Like, that would be, this is probably hard to prove.
Yeah. I think you'd have to be kind of rich to start off with for a lawyer to want to go after you.
Right. Exactly. It is very expensive.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing she brings up is that most people that are offended by something in the memoir are not going to take legal action because that brings attention to the thing they're offended about. And they'll have to prove that you were wrong. And that means bringing up other things. And it's just easier for them not to say anything and hope it goes away.
Right, just give them a little penis and then they don't want people to know about their penis. Just kidding. So the one thing she mentions, what I think is really great, riffs off of what she said in chapter 9. Your publisher will be concerned about any possible legal action. So don't worry about it. And your publisher will take care of it.
Because they've done lots of memoirs and they've dealt with more horrible people than are in your book. And they know how these things work. And that's the case even if you sign a contract that says, you know, I will take all legal responsibility for what's in this book, because they don't want to have the pain of a lawsuit coming through.
Right. And because don't they sue the publisher? They're not suing you. They're suing the publisher, right?
They probably sue both.
So both. Okay.
I mean, it's one of those things that you sign a contract that says I absolve the publishing company. But the person suing, like, you know, why not sue the publishing company? They got money.
Yeah, that's true. Well, okay. So in this appendix, which we found very interesting and helpful, she gave us simplified facts.
A lot of bullet points.
Yes, a lot of bullet points. And she says there are two general areas of the law that apply to your writing. One is defamation, and the other one is
invasion of privacy.
So defamation, which include libel, so libel is written defamation, and slander is spoken defamation.
So what this is when you say something about someone that isn't true and it hurts them financially, their business or their contacts that they have, or if they get a certain amount of money from their face and name recognition.
Right. Say Uncle Bob owns a deli and you mention the cockroaches or something.
Right.
Yeah, that might mess up his business a little bit. And if it's a lie, you're in big trouble.
Yes. If it's true, he may just decide not to talk about it.
That's true. He may be like, oh, I don't want anyone to know. The other one is invasion of privacy or protection of personality rights. I think that's weird, in protection of personality. They're concerned mainly with the publication of offensive, embarrassing, or misleading facts about a person and with the unfair exploitation for profit of someone's image or name.
Right, so if you include someone famous in your book and you talk smack about them and people buy the book because you talk smack about them, because they want to find out what this famous person did.
No, it's not necessarily about famous people.
Well, but you have to be famous to be someone that's getting a profit off your name or image.
That's true. So, yeah, I guess, yeah, whatever your image is, if somebody has an image, I guess you're right.
Mm-hmm.
Publication of offensive, embarrassing, or misleading facts about a person and with the unfair exploitation for profit of someone's image or name. Well, you also misleading facts. What if you lied?
Right.
So the person's not famous, but you're just lying.
Right.
You know, you're a pumpkin eater or whatever, and you're just telling people all sorts of falsehoods.
Mm-hmm. She goes through some actual terms and ideas with each of them. And so we'll start with the defamation, and then we'll go to the invasion of privacy. And I think that covers a bit of the public and private person. So as I always said, for defamation, first of all, it has to be false. If you say that someone, you know, was drunk driving and hit a person and went to jail for it, and it's true, you know, they may not like the fact that you brought it up and wrote about it, but they don't really have any recourse there.
Right. They don't want you talking about it, but you did. They can't sue you just because you brought it up, because it is true.
It has to be published, which obviously for the purposes of a memoir, it would be published. Mm-hmm. So if you want to write a private memoir that is only going to like see the light of day after you're dead or whatever, then, you know, you can keep that in your drawer for as long as you want. It can say whatever you want. Or you could write the piece, you could put it in the drawer until they're dead. Because another thing about it is that, I'm going to jump ahead, but it has to be about a living person.
Yeah.
You can speak ill of the dead.
Yes, you can.
Because they financially no longer have a stake.
Right.
And someone can't sue you because of something you said about their dead grandmother.
Okay.
But back up again here. It has to be stated as a fact.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not opinion.
Right. And this makes me wonder if you can get away with it by saying things like, as far as I know. I mean, like, if you add a qualifier in there like
that. As far as I know, no one's found the dead body that George buried in the backyard.
Right. Well, maybe that. A little bird told me, you know, Grandma used to feed his expired food. I don't know. I don't know if that will get you off the hook. I know that it is, a lot of books and a lot of the advice I've received has been to be very clear about what you know and what you don't, and I follow that rule. Will it get you out of a legal issue? I don't know. But it might. So just be clear, like, if you're saying something that someone's going to be offended by, and they're going to be like, state it as fact, you know, and it's like, maybe if you just said it more as an opinion, you might get away with it.
Well, you're also really interrogating whether you know something or you don't know something. And so you're being very careful to only state the things you know as facts and the other things as speculation. And so when you're writing a memoir, if you're speculating, you think it would sound really good to say that as a fact, maybe you shouldn't do that.
Or just say it as speculation.
Yeah.
Right.
I always wondered, but right. I never had any evidence.
So the problem in my case is that I could say somebody did a thing and all they have to say is no, she didn't. Or no, I didn't. Mm-hmm. It's just their word over mine.
Right.
So that's what worries me is like, well, I know this happened for a fact, but all that other person has to say is no, it didn't. That's it.
Yeah.
I mean, what proof do I have besides my memory and their memory?
Yeah. So, because you don't have anyone to collaborate for you.
Exactly. It's a little confusing in my situation, but let's just keep going.
About a named or identifiable person. Which is probably why whenever you see a movie, there's always, or a book, there's always a thing about fiction that always says that the names and events are only coincidentally identical to people.
So you could just change their name.
Yeah, although it's identifiable person. So you can't say my sister Nellie when you don't have a sister Nellie, but you do have a sister.
Okay. So you can't just change your brother's name and expect to get away with it because they know your brother.
But if, say, you had an encounter with somebody in college.
Right.
In your psych class.
No one's going to know.
Then you could easily say that it happened your freshman year in your biology class and this person looked this way and all that. And in that case, the person really isn't going to raise their hand and say, hey, that person there is me. In fact, if you ignore all these things, because I said that.
Well, that's it. Yeah, but that's not going to hurt you.
No. And then finally, the last point we haven't covered is damaging or injurious to the person concerned.
It says your statements must cause the person to be held in public contempt or hatred or must interfere with her or his ability to succeed financially or professionally or must cause her or him to lose a spouse.
Whoa. If your wife or husband divorces you because of what's written in there, I mean, technically you have suffered financial.
That's true. So I guess it really comes down to financial stuff.
Yeah, well, it's because you're proving that you were injured, and unfortunately, you really can't prove that your feelings were so hurt,
right?
That you need to have, you know, more money,
right?
You can prove that, you know, these things happened, and my community wouldn't let me do this thing, and I'm like all this stuff that, you know, you can tally it up.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Now she moves on to, you should also bear in mind that legally, different standards are set for how public and private people are written about. If you're writing about a private person, you have to be a lot more careful.
Okay.
Because a public person is already out there.
So, like, you're a journalist, right?
Mm-hmm. I can say all sorts of stuff about the governor and stuff the governor did. What I couldn't say about just somebody that has a business that never has been in the public eye.
Okay. But why?
Because, okay, so the difference is that a public person bringing a lawsuit against you would have to prove that you made the defamatory statement with what is called actual malice. Let's say I said that there were cockroaches in a business. So if that person's not public, just the statement itself would be enough if it was non-true and they could prove it. But if I were to say that the governor kept dogs that attacked people or almost attacked people, then I'd have to be on top of wanting to just report this. He couldn't sue me because I reported it. They could sue me if I had a bone to pick with them and I wanted those dogs, you know, I wanted those dogs to suffer. I wanted them to suffer. There's actual malice behind it.
Interesting. Okay. Okay. So,
and part of the malice, I think, as I recall from journalism, like, is there an actual public good for why you're reporting these things? And, you know, say the government does have nasty dogs. That would be a public good.
That's true. All right. Then she moves on to the invasion of privacy, protection of personality rights. Mm-hmm. She says the publication of offensive or embarrassing private facts about a person, about an identifiable person. The definition of what is offensive or embarrassing is based on the community standards of your locale. What?
Well, it's embarrassing. So that means that basically if someone's living in the middle of New York City and like versus if someone's living in an Amish community.
Okay.
If someone from big city, I wrote that they got pregnant, had a kid out of wedlock.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be that big of a deal. Oh. But if I was writing about someone in the Amish community that did that.
So how scandalous.
Yes.
Okay. We're talking about scandal here. Interesting. So wait, but what, I mean, if it's true, if what you're telling about them is true, so what if it's embarrassing to them? They shouldn't have done it. I don't know.
Yeah, that's a little bit less flexible. I mean, when I was reading this, I was also thinking that probably when you sue, you kind of sue for both these things, possibly.
Mm.
And so, like, if you can prove the defamation, then this kind of goes along with it. So it's kind of like an add-on. Because I've noticed that sometimes people get sued for multiple things or multiple.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. And then she said, using facts in a way that conveys a person in a false light. Facts are used to mislead, though the facts may be true. Ooh. To mislead. How would you do that?
Well, you could say, when we did landscaping in my uncle's backyard, we never dug up any bodies.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay.
Although the dog was sniffing out around the woods very strongly.
Yeah. There's just one spot in the backyard under the strawberry plants. Okay. All right. Then using someone's name or picture for commercial gain without consent. Huh.
And I think this is something that your publisher would handle because they'd be going through and looking at how you used the person's name. I suppose that would be like if you were advertising, come read this memoir, it's about this famous person's teenage years.
Right.
Then that might not be as good. Or if you have their picture on the advertisements for the book reading.
Or, well, actually, I've seen some memoirs that have like family photos in them.
Right.
Maybe that would have an issue.
Well, that's still in the book. If you had the family photos for like commercial purposes to get people to do book signing and to read your stuff, again, you could point to exactly how much the person might have made by using that person's picture.
Okay. Then she concludes the chapter with precautions.
Yes.
So precaution number one,
tell the truth.
There you go. Bam.
Yep.
Make sure you have evidence to back up your claim, she says. That's a very journalistic point of view on things.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay, so here's the thing. When you write nonfiction, and memoir in this case is nonfiction in that regards, you have fact-checking. And you say, you know, here's my journal from this time period. Here's the newspaper clippings I used. Here's the Google Map image that I used. And a publisher will have a person that is in charge of just fact-checking and going through all these things. And so they know that they can, if anything comes up, they've got it handy.
Right. But again, like I'm saying, this may not always, you know, save you. Like, what if your sister was a bully, right? Bullies never admit it, right? Like, she was like a, you know, a terror growing up. And you say, my sister was a bully. And you could describe the things that she did. And then she sues you. And she's like, I never did those things.
Well, the question is, did she lose something financially because people know she's a bully? She'd have to prove that. Okay. Or she'd have to say that, you know, being a bully in our household and in my community is such a bad thing that everybody hates me now because you said that I was a bully.
Or she could just say, I wasn't.
Well, she could say that too.
No, and that's all it takes.
Right. No, you'd have to, yeah, you, hiring the lawyer and all that other stuff only counts if you can show that you've had some sort of damage.
I see.
Monetary damage. And so I think that that falls in the category that... But here's the other thing, too. If you're writing about your sister being a bully, you should have some other evidence out there. You should have some a friend that you told at one time, or your mother having a conversation with your mother or something about it, or maybe you wrote your diary at the time that you, you know, if you can pull out the diary that shows that she was really mean to you today and this is how it made you feel.
Right.
So, like, honestly, I don't know if you should be writing about that if you don't have some outside evidence to collaborate, because our memories are faulty, too.
Yes. Yeah, okay. Well,
and specificity is also important, too. So you want to say, you know, on the 4th of July picnic in 1972, this and this happened. These were the people here, and this is what my sister did.
It could also be better to just cut them out.
Yeah, if that's not critical for the story.
Right. Express your opinions as opinions. We've gone back to that now.
Mm-hmm.
Just make sure that it's an opinion. Add qualifiers, you know, as far as I know. I've actually read in memoirs people saying, my brother might tell a different story, but the one I remember is.
Mm-hmm.
So those kinds of things might save you.
Attribute controversial statements to others. If somebody else wants to say your sister's a bully, quote them.
Oh, that's what that means. Okay. My friend said your sister's a bully.
Right.
Mm. Okay.
Get consent from those you want to write about. We talked about that. Change names and disguise people. And don't worry forever. I think this is a good one. There's something called a statute of limitations. And that means, depending on the state, between 1 and 2 years after your book is published, if they haven't said anything, they can't say anything. I mean, they can't, or they can say something, but they can't go after you at that point if they haven't already gone after you.
Right. And so maybe one thing that will save me is that since, you know, the living people who I'm writing about don't really read,
mm-hmm.
It'll be okay. Maybe they'll never find it.
Yep.
And if and when they do, it'll be too late.
Right. Or the way I see it is this just shows that you need to have the movie be made 2 years after the publication, and then you're set.
Right. That's funny. Well, movies take a while, right, to make. So I think you're probably safe. So as long as maybe your family members aren't readers, you know, and they don't catch it in time,
then they can't do anything about it.
And you're cool.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So this is a little weird, because what kind of activity are we going to do?
Okay, so like I said, we weren't going to do anything from the...
appendix.
not the appendix. We weren't going to do anything that was highly personable about writing about living people, because this is a podcast. So we did find one of the prompts that said, think about a street name from a place you lived once. Describe that street name in great detail. List stores or houses, anyone you know who lived there, things you remember happening on that street.
There you go.
Yeah.
So that's the one we decided to do.
Mm-hmm. And because it's the second recording, we actually took care so there's no break point. We're just going to straight to reading what we wrote. So I already have mine written. And overall, sometimes I'm really excited to read the piece that I've written because it tapped into something pretty awesome. And this one was so-so. I think that sometimes it's hard to call up worthy stuff of a memoir writing off the top of your head.
I don't know. Don't stop apologizing. Just read your stuff.
All right. So I've been gone from Madison for 10 years, but I still have 20 years of memories starting from when I moved there as a brand new college freshman until I was all grown up with a family and career and a web of familiar faces from all those times and life stages. The Madison I arrived to was when I was 18 was different from the one that I left when I was 39. Bigger, taller, shinier. And the version that I see on Google Street Maps is different still, with buildings and streets that I have no connection with that could be from any Midwest city, but when I look further, I see traces of the life I once lived. Take Monroe Street. Starting at its acute, obtuse intersection with Regent, at the southwest corner of the university, in the shadow of Camp Randall Stadium. Most days it's just gray and silent, but on those home game days, it would flood the streets with red and white clad fans. If I timed my weekend time at the lab wrong, I'd be caught in the waves of people leaving, either buoyant or sober, depending on the final score, and in the background, the university band playing the fifth quarter. The university's influences extend another block with Mickey's Dairy Bar and a couple of frat houses and a P6 Dream outpost to deliver to the students who rented so many of the apartments in the area. But beyond that, it became a more cozy, quirky shopping street with 1- and 2-story brick buildings that open onto the sidewalk that hugs the curb, What trees there are small and ornamental. Most of that quirky is boutique now, but in my memory, I recall some entrenched oddball businesses. Walter Swimman's Son, with a tanning booth in the back. A shop that sold cross-country skis and tennis supplies, whose name even Google search can't find.
Yeah.
And affordable futons, for back when you couldn't buy them at Costco or Target. As college students, newly in love, we purchased our first mattress there and did well enough on the carpeted floors of our east side apartment. When, a few years later, we moved closer to the center of town to an apartment with all wood floors, we upgraded to a new, real bed. We returned to affordable futons to purchase the modern frame, and the futon became a couch. The cover was dark purple and red abstract pattern with splashes of yellow and black on it that, honestly, was less hideous than you might be imagining. Our next move was down Monroe Street, past the now vacated affordable futons, and up and down a hill to a side street right after an old brick fire station that had been converted to a community theater office and set storage area. No one permanent moved into the old futon store, although they did rent the space out to Obama's 2008 campaign, and I volunteered there to do phone banking, pressed up against the large display windows looking out onto the street. According to Google, it's now a fitness gym.
Nice.
Yeah, I think I didn't quite do the location justice, because when I was originally imagining doing it, I was going to do all the various businesses along the way and some other memories I had of them. And here I kind of like got to the futon store, and I just sort of explored the idea of the futon store and then moved to where I moved
right.
it along.
Well, okay, so I like, you said most of that quirky is boutique now. I'm reading literally on the thing. Most of that quirky is boutique now, but in my memory, I recall some entrenched oddball business. Now, you could have just said that, but no. You followed it up with names. You're like Walter Swimman's Son and this tanning booth and the cross-country ski store. I mean, affordable futons. And, well, you know, hearkening back to the 90s, I remember futons were the thing. They were everywhere, right? Like, everyone got futons because they were cheap and they could turn into a couch and everyone was broke when you're a college student.
And they're way more comfortable than sofa beds.
Way more comfortable than sofa beds, and they don't look that bad on the floor. They look a lot better than just a lonely mattress on the floor. Anyway, so I think you did pretty good justice, because I caught myself like wandering around with you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, oh, okay, I can imagine myself in like a quirky college town and I'm wandering the streets and seeing these stores.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't have had that experience had you not mentioned the Mickey's Dairy Barn.
Mm-hmm.
What the heck is a dairy barn?
It should have been Mixie. Maybe I wrote down Mickey's Dairy Bar. It was just a breakfast diner place.
Okay.
This is Wisconsin.
Is there a bar and they actually give you milk?
No.
But okay. You never know. And then there's this Pizza Extreme Outpost.
It was like the local pizza delivery place there. And, you know, in the Midwest, ordering pizza is cheap.
Okay. I don't know. I think you give yourself short shrift here. You're, you know, that apologizing before you started. I think it's really good.
Yeah. Well, I guess part of my thing is like, at a certain point, I just got tired. I'm just going to wrap this up with what happened to affordable futons and leave it at that.
Maybe if it was revised, there would be more like your personal feelings. I mean, it came out in The Voice, but maybe if you added more people to it, it would make it come alive more.
Mm-hmm. I think if I were to extend this to an actual chapter, I would keep moving down the street and all the various memories, and I would set up so the final place we got was turning into the house to where we moved in.
Right. So I know you didn't like the chapter very much of the naming names,
mm-hmm.
Of place names, but I don't know, now that you've done this activity, do you have like a new understanding or?
No, because I was trained by a journalist. I've always done this stuff.
Okay, so this is just old hat. You don't understand why there's a chapter on this.
I understand why there's a chapter on it. It didn't do it for me.
Okay.
Which is okay.
You know, you reading it, I was getting some Joan Didion vibes. So
I think, any other questions for me about this?
I don't know. You were just writing it. You weren't that excited about it, but you did it, and I liked it. I think Barrington would have been happy.
Yeah, I think I would have counted for an assignment.
Yeah, and like you got the lay of the land down, and I feel like you could just start in on a story now. Like
yeah.
You all right, I know where I am. You've placed me in time and place. Now you can go tell the story.
And I will say that writing this exercise is way easier with Google Maps, especially the street view. And then if a place is gone, a different business has gone in there, you can kind of Google the street name and the type of business. And I found most of the businesses that I needed to find.
because I didn't remember what Walter Swimming Sun and Swim was. I knew it was there, but I couldn't remember the. But you know, it was there in the Google. So
cool.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't take very long to Google a place. It doesn't take very. I mean, the other thing too is Street View is a fantastic. Just walk yourself down, and you'll realize, oh, there's a lot more space here. Oh, there was that. There was a couple of buildings that were completely uninteresting here that you wouldn't have. You're just going by memory.
Yeah. Also, I think is interesting, like if you went through your piece and you took out all the proper nouns, it wouldn't sound good.
No.
So that's another reason why you put them in.
Proper names sound different. Like you're always searching for ways to refer to something and not use the same description again and again. And a proper name is.
Right. And then the dairy bar. I mean, that adds a lot. I'm just like, a dairy bar. Okay, we're in Wisconsin. Okay, this is a Wisconsin thing.
Mm-hmm.
Or, yeah, I mean, I don't know, California. We're not good at geography. We're pretty isolated out here if you were born here. So just saying there, dear listener, I'm not very good with it.
This also goes to show that stuff that is incredibly mundane and boring to you is actually really entertaining for other people to read.
Yes, it is. Totally is. I like memoirs of place.
Yeah, and either it's going to be great because they'd never heard of this. This is brand new. Or it's going to be great because I said, you know, I used to go to Mickey's Dairy Bar back in the day. I remember that.
Yeah.
So you can't lose. Yeah. You can only lose by, like, messing it up.
Right, or talking smack about it, and then you're, like, inviting. Well, I don't know. I would talk smack about some things in Monterey, but we'll see.
We'll see.
All right, well, good job.
All right. Well, thank you guys all for listening. And it did record.
And we're good.
Recorded! Woohoo! We're going to do Renee's piece next week, so you can tune in then. If you are enjoying this podcast, we would love it if you went to the place you're listening to and just rated us. Just say that you like us. It helps people find the podcast.
That would be awesome.
Yes.
Please do that.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Words to Write By is produced by Renee Nelson and Kim Smith-Adam. Our theme music is Roll Back the Carpet by Cool Cat Music. Have a great day.
Yes, dear listener, that was a little dig. She likes to poke the bear.